offender's apology. I would like to suggest, because De Kaleri will not be able to stay. We thank her for being here. She's not well. But because we're voting on the minutes, she kindly agreed to be here. So to accommodate her, and according to what I see in Kuleleko, we do have a quorum, I would like to suggest we take the minutes quickly, and that won't take long. If I'm right, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes. So let's start with the 23rd of March. Minutes of the 23rd of March. Are there any comments, colleagues? 23rd of March.
Good morning, Chair.
Yes, Mr. Njalu.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. No, Chair, the minutes are correct. And I would propose for the adoption of those minutes.
Thank you. Is there a seconder?
I'll second, Yunus. William.
Thank you very much. Then you'll help me along if I get the sequence wrong. I did tell the committee openly I got an E for maths and E for science, so I'm not great. So after the 23rd of March, the next date seems to be the 11th of May. So 11th of May, colleagues, any comments on the 11th of May? That's on the PBO on the ERRP, 11th of May. Mover and seconder, if there aren't any comments. Sorry, Mr. Jatoy, yes?
I moved.
Thank you, Mr. Jatoy. And seconder, please.
I second, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mamara Khale. Then, if I'm correct, next is 18th of May. It's a briefing by IRBA. Any comments, any changes, any additions? I did have a look at all of these minutes in the last 2 days or so.
Yunus, I'll move.
Thank you. Seconder? Thank you. Okay, so that's the 18th of May. Then we've got the 25th of May, colleagues. This is a briefing by PBO and NT on the crypto assets matter. Comments, please.
Yunus, I move. Billy.
Okay, seconder?
Second, Chair, the 20th.
Thank you. That's the 25th of May, then the 1st of June. This one
I
is
move,
on
Chair.
Briefing by the Land Bank.
I move, Chair.
Thank you. Seconder?
I second, Chair.
Okay, and then we have finally the 8th of June. That was last week, the PBO briefing.
I move, Chair.
Seconder?
I second, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, just a question to cover the staff that processed these minutes. And I think I'd like to table this here so that there's no confusion. You see, in our minutes, we say some pretty banal things. And I gather from the committee staff that this is the requirement or guidelines that are provided by the committee, the committee section. Now, can I suggest, colleagues, that, the committee section can't override the committee on basic stuff. So, for example, this idea that the minutes should record that, let's say, National Treasury proceeded with its presentation, full stop. And then somewhere else goes, say, National Treasury completed its presentation, full stop. The members were then given a chance to interact with the presentation. Then somewhere else it says the chairperson thanked the members for their presence. Now, I don't know what other committees do, and it's not for me to say. But because I sign it, ultimately, no one's going to notice who the committee staff were and so on. My name goes to it, and I cannot agree to such things because it's pretty banal to say that National Treasury proceeded with its presentation and ended it, and then the members asked questions. Obviously, that's why we're here. So quite frankly, that's not going to be allowed. Is there anybody who feels strongly you want the minutes to record that National Treasury or PBO proceeded with its presentation full stop, and then elsewhere will record it ended its presentation or something like that, and then say the members were then given a chance to interact? Anybody wants that sort of thing in minutes? Good. So we are agreeing, staff, you don't need to put that. Then things like the chairperson thanked the NGOs and the members were attending. Now, you can't thank the members were attending because the members are supposed to be there. That's what we get paid for. That's what we get elected to do. So you can't thank people for, doing what you're supposed to do anyway. Anybody wants to be thanked for coming to meetings? Because I'm going to refuse to do it. I can tell you now. I'm not thanking you to come to a meeting.
No, you must continue to thank people regardless. It's a good practice.
Why must we thank members? No, we must thank the NGOs for coming. We must thank National Treasury. No, I'm not going to agree to that. No, I'm not thanking members to be here. Why are we elected if not to be admitted and do our related work? No, I'm not going to agree to that, Zolani. You can take that up with the Chief Whip or the Secretary of Parliament. I refuse to do that. Actually, I refuse on principle. I'm not thanking members for coming to meetings, which we are paid in the first instance elected to do. What am I supposed to thank them for? No, I'm not going to agree.
You are not obliged to thank you. It's not mandatory. It's voluntary. So it's fine. You can just do it from a point of view of being, it's an act of kindness. It doesn't mean that you are compelled.
Yes. I'm not talking about that. That I would do as a courtesy, but it's not to be recorded. It's embarrassing, actually, to say the chairperson thanks the Gender Action Group, COSATU, Business Unity South Africa, I don't know who, Equality Before the Law, and all that, and the members for being present. No, we don't minute that. As a courtesy, in any case, I do thank you. But to minute that, it's banal. Let's leave out banalities, please. Let's deal with the substance. Okay, good. Right. Remember, I am accountable to the committee, and I'm accountable to the norms of Parliament. But silly rules, no. And that's finally only the Chief Whip and the NCOP chairperson will instruct me to do, because there are some things really, like the meeting proceeded, full stop, the submissions proceeded, full stop. The reason I'm bringing it before this committee is because, A, the staff have been given these guidelines, and then they have to do it. I raised it with a staff member, and I was told, well, we have to do this. Secondly, in my many years here, sometimes the committee section does some wacky things, really. And it's embarrassing, really. It makes no sense. So, like, that sort of stuff, just to cover the staff, it's ministered staff. You don't have to do those things. Having said that, yes, I will thank you. And for that, well, okay, Zolani, since you really want to be thanked so much, let me start with you in Kosi and Kiva. We are utterly honored and deeply moved and very emotional that you are here. And we want to thank you profusely from the bottom of my heart. It goes to Mkiva for being here. Thank you. Please don't minute that. I'll write it out separately and send it to the Nkosi, and he'll put it up there and frame it in his, in his traditional court and in his traditional community meetings. They will have it there. How's that? All right. On a more serious note, can we get going? Treasury, you're here, and over to you. And you're going to brief us on the bill. Colleagues, this is an informal briefing before people start threatening to take us to court and walk out of the meeting and all that. There isn't time for all that. So basically, this is an informal briefing. It's allowed in terms of parliamentary rules. If Frank Jenkins is here, he can explain offline to people. We've been doing this since 94. This meeting has no like status until, beyond just informing us and saving time, until the National Assembly votes on it, which will presumably be around the 3rd or 4th week of August, because when we all come back, it will be committee week, I think, for a week or two. So maybe even early September. Now, it's a very short 3 to 4 weeks when we come back. So that's why we are processing only what the bill is as passed by the committee, not by the NA House. Thank you very much. Over to you, colleagues. Where are we, colleagues? From National Treasury. I know we got one apology from your team. Who's here?
Good morning, Chair.
Yes, my friend. Okay. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Chair. I would like to start by actually thanking you and the committee for affording us this opportunity this morning.
Thank you for being here. Thank you.
Excellent. I am going to try and share the presentation that was sent, and I don't know whether this will be coordinated on your side or ours.
Nkululeko can help you.
Okay, if we could allow, if you could bear with me for a second, Chair, while we share the presentation. Okay. I don't know if members can see that.
Yes, we can, my friend.
Okay. So, again, thank you, Chair. What we will be doing today is taking you through the Financial Sectors Law Amendment Bill, a set of amendments that seek to introduce powers to improve resolvability of systemically important financial institutions, as well as additional powers to minimize disruption to the financial sector and minimize costs to the fiscus. In addition, the amendments propose to introduce a deposit insurance scheme for the first time, an instrument that we believe will allow for the protection of the most vulnerable depositors, as well as further aligning incentives in the financial sector. And what I mean by that is reducing moral hazard and making the institutions that benefit from services to pay for or to be more accountable for when things go wrong. To start off with, Chair, maybe I thought I'd just introduce the team that's on the call. As you noted, we have received apologies from DDG Mamonia, who is a little bit ill today. I am Vuyile Davidson, and I'm joined by Janine and Lange from the National Treasury, as well as Nicola from the Financial Stability section of the Reserve Bank, Jacques Bertus, head of the Resolution Department, Henrik Nall, the CEO of the Deposit Insurance scheme, as well as Sabiha Masenya and Pragasan, all from the central bank. I'm going to start with a bit of background, Chair, if you'd allow. In 2011, the Financial Sector Laws Amendment Bill, which was part of the Twin Peaks framework, was introduced. This followed the 2008 global financial crisis, where 1 million South Africans lost their jobs, despite South Africa not being the epicenter of the crisis. In 2011, Treasury published a broad policy paper making a safer financial sector to serve South Africa better. Cabinet adopted the policy in that year, and in that policy paper, the paper advocated for more intensive, intrusive, and effective financial regulation. The bill itself was introduced in 2015, as you may remember, Chair, and finally enacted in 2017. The Twin Peaks bill introduced a prudential authority as well as a financial sector conduct authority, which were established in 2018. The Prudential Authority deals with issues of safety and soundness of financial institutions, while the Financial Sector Conduct Authority deals with the market conduct and consumer protection issues. So what we've done in South Africa is that so in South Africa at the moment, covering regulatory issues for the financial sector, we have around 10 acts covering various aspects, all of which are under the Ministry of Finance, with the exception of the National Credit Act. In parallel, other legislation that have been done in conjunction with Twin Peaks are the 2012 Financial Markets Act, as well as the Banks Act, the Banks Act Amendment that was done in 2015, which was really in response to the African bank failure and allowed for the transfer of asset and liabilities in a separate entity into good versus bad bank, all in aid of facilitating an orderly resolution of that bank at the time. There have been many other framework papers published as well in the period following the 2011 broad policy paper on a broad array of topics, including market conduct, crypto assets, financial markets, and deposit insurance. The COFI bill is the key outstanding bill that still needs to be processed by Parliament and has gone to Cabinet on multiple occasions so far. In 2015, National Treasury, the Reserve Bank, and FSCA published a second specific paper on strengthening South Africa's resolution framework for financial institutions. And it's this paper that forms the basis of the bill that we will be, that is currently before Parliament. So why do we need this bill? Chair and committee members, as you may recall, as demonstrated by the 2008 global financial crisis, banking risks are very closely linked to sovereign risk in a sort of doom loop or what others may term a sovereign banking nexus. And what this means, Chair, is that stresses and risks can emanate from either the banking or financial sector that can contaminate and constrain the fiscus, as well as running the other way, which is stresses in the sovereign in the quality of the sovereign. Can spill over into the financial sector and therefore the broader economy. So this interaction that leads to one sphere, the government being able to contaminate the financial sector and vice versa, was the basis of the Eurozone crisis in 2009. 10, 11, and 12, where a set of countries at the time referred to as the PIGS, which refers to Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Greece, and Spain. The weakness in the banking sectors ultimately led to a severe crisis for the fiscus, which ultimately led to huge fiscal consolidations, as authorities there were left with no option but to safeguard the financial sector. Bank weaknesses can foreshadow big costs for government budgets, as I've outlined, Chair. Over the past three decades, banking crises have contributed to large increases in public debt, as we saw in those five European countries that I had mentioned earlier. We've seen from that crisis and others that the median cost of direct government intervention in banking crisis was at least 7 percentage points of GDP. The direct and indirect fiscal costs of a post-crisis recession that emanates from such a stress are an increase in public debt 4 years after the beginning of the crisis of on average 12% of GDP. So, Chair, the implications of bank failures for the sovereign are massive and difficult to overstate. In many countries, public debt has increased more than 20% of GDP, and we don't have to go too back in history to see these devastating effects, Chair, as we saw in the Eurozone crisis following the global financial crisis. It's important to remember, Chair, that pre-crisis characteristics and crisis management policies matter. The consequences of a banking crisis on government finances and spending are therefore significant and as I've outlined in the previous slide. I'll just provide further evidence of this in a study, Chair, of 187 banking crises across 126 countries over the period covering the 70s to the period immediately after the global financial crisis. The study shows that the impact of the crisis not only on the economy and the financial sector, but also on other social areas and fiscal policy priorities like health, education, poverty, and gender issues. The broad ranging implications for society include declines in average life expectancy, primary school enrollment, and considerable short run worsening of poverty and income inequality. Governments, Chair, as we saw in 2012 and 2009, are constrained and simply cannot allow banks to fail as they provide crucial services for the broader economy. This constraint that governments face, Chair, and that really forces them because of the huge social and economic costs is a phenomenon that has been termed too big to fail in the post-crisis years. And this is why, Chair, banks are often compared to nuclear facilities and described as systemically important financial institutions. The failure of a bank has a domino effect on other banks and financial institutions because of this interconnection. And result in devastating and far-reaching problems for the entire economic system. So governments will do whatever it takes to avoid this outcome, including necessary but often very unpopular bailouts of banks. This problem, Chair, is a moral hazard problem and must be dealt with, as banks may then take increasing risks knowing that ultimately, because of their centrality and systemic importance, and the fact that they are too big to fail, this can allow them to take ever-increasing risks, knowing that ultimately, because of this importance, government will have no option but to save them in the event of a severe crisis. And this is the case where profits are privatized, but losses are socialized. And this has been the experience in the not too distant past, as I outlined earlier. So in this way, Chair, banks are different from other companies and therefore require a failure management process different to the normal insolvency process, and stronger and more comprehensive than the current curatorship framework that currently exists in the banks, within the Banks Act. Banks work on trust, and the moment a depositor even has a sense or hears rumors that a bank is in trouble, it's rational for depositors of that bank to rush to withdraw their deposits. It is in the nature of banking that no bank can keep 100% of the cash that depositors place in funds, because banks provide this the central liquidity transformation function of intermediating loans, deposits into long-term investments. So the structural characteristics of banks always makes them vulnerable to runs of a bank or coordinated withdrawal from a bank, and this underscores the central importance of trust in the banking sector to keep the banking system stable and able to provide the necessary economic functions. Like almost every country, we have curatorship for banks before insolvency mechanisms are utilized. But as a consequence of what we learned in 2008 and 2012 in Europe, but not only that, as a consequence of our own experience in South Africa, in African Bank and VBS, we know that we require additional tools to safeguard the financial system and minimize moral hazard. And this is the resolution and deposit insurance framework that we are today proposing. So, just to give you, Chair, and the committee a sense of the road traveled so far relating to the framework we'll be proposing in following the 2008 global financial crisis. It was recognized, Chair, that risk is not only to the domestic economy, but a failure of a systemically important financial institution affects banks and the economies of other jurisdictions. This is especially the case for deeply regionally integrated banking and financial systems, as we have in Southern Africa, where South African banks are also central in many of our neighbors' economies. In 2008, South African banks did remain safe, and South Africa was not the epicenter of the crisis, but the spillovers and the knock-on effects still resulted in almost a million South Africans losing their jobs in that period. In 2009, therefore, Chair, then President Zuma and other G20 heads of state committed to measures to addressing too big to fail for banks and other systemically important financial institutions. In 2010, at the Seoul Summit, G20 heads of state again endorsed the framework for reducing moral hazard for systemically important financial institutions. The objective of this SIFI framework is to address the systemic risk and the associated moral hazard problem for institutions that are seen as too big to fail. It does so by making SIFI stronger, more resilient, as well as policy measures to make sure that they can be resolved in the event that they do fail, which is an important point, Chan. The framework is not meant to prevent failure, but to allow for mechanisms for failure in a way that doesn't affect the broader economy. Regulators plan for what happens in the event of financial stress as well. And this is called resolution planning or living wills, which in the US, as an example, is a mandatory annual submission that systemically important banks and other financial institutions need to make to regulate. So this slide, Chair, just gives a sense of what I outlined in the previous slide. I'll just turn to what's been happening domestically in parallel to what's happened in internationally. So we've been keeping pace of our international commitments, informed by the experience in other countries, but like I say, Chair, also informed very importantly by what was happening domestically in our own experiences relating to stresses of banks and other systemically important financial institutions. I've mentioned, Chair, the policy paper that formed the basis of the framework. In 2012, Chair, as well, I've highlighted that we had further work relating to the Financial Markets Act and a policy paper specifically focused on resolution in 2015. the amendment bill as well in 2015 and an additional paper outlining how the proposed deposit insurance scheme would work, published in 2017. In 2019, the Reserve Bank published a paper on ending too big to fail and South Africa's intended approach to bank resolution. Okay, I'm going to skip over the slide, Chair, because this just further underscores what I was highlighting previously. I will now, Chair, outline the problems that we seek to address. A lot of these I've already alluded to in the context of our experience, but I will now go into the specific policy or the specific problem statements that we'll be intend to address in the bill. And that is, first, minimizing the use of public funds and reducing moral hazard, as I've outlined. The costs of failure of the SIFI are borne by the general public through the intervention of the government. But as I've outlined, the problem is that the profits are made by investors in good times. And this problem is central to the measures and the proposals in the bill. In addition to, Chair, planning for failure was central. And this is making sure we have the tools to resolve a systemically important financial institution with minimum disruption to the economy. To do this, Chair, the resolution framework will do the following four things. It will adopt bail-in as opposed to bail-out. And this is it's out of a recognition that we need to move from a culture of bailouts, from taxpayer-funded bailouts, and impose losses on the creditors and the shareholders who profit in good times to absorb losses in bad times. Secondly, Chair, need for complex and comprehensive SIFIs to plan for the possibility of failure through resolution planning, comprehensive resolution plans to allow for the orderly resolution to be feasible. Thirdly, the need for a depositor protection framework and scheme. And its recognition in the liquidation process to safeguard vulnerable depositors and make sure that they are protected, which is currently not the case in the framework. Lastly, Chair, is a need for a legal framework that goes beyond the current curatorship business rescue provisions due to the critical functions that are provided by financial institutions. I'm going to go through to the current legal gaps that the framework will address, Chair. The Banks Act currently only provides for curatorship, which is limited in scope and does not apply to non-bank financial institutions and is inadequate for the failure of non-bank systemically important financial institutions, which could be equally devastating to the economy. Secondly, Companies Act provides for business rescue proceedings. But this does not give due regard to the nature and the complexity of large, complex financial institutions operating across multiple jurisdictions. Thirdly, the Insolvency Act only applies in liquidation proceedings. It does not recognize depositor as a preferred creditor in the creditor hierarchy. Fourthly, there's no pre-identified resolution authority with commensurate powers and functions to deal with group-wide resolution and financial conglomerates. Fifth, fragmentation of the law currently, and there's a need to align and provide for the cooperation provisions between regulators like the Prudential Authority, the Reserve Bank, and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority as well. Sixth, there's no legal provision for resolution planning for banks, which is, as I've illustrated, critical for the framework, for systemically important non-bank financial institutions and their holding companies. Seven, Chair, bailouts based on a case-by-case basis, and they're not in accordance with the UNIFIL standard principles defined in law. Eighth, Chair, there's a lack of depositor protection in resolution, explicit depositor protection in resolution. And lastly, Chair, the applicant does not have an explicitly private funded deposit insurance scheme. Past compensations, Chair, have all been done on an ad hoc basis, funded by the government, subject to available funding and the budget process, which, as you know, Chair, can be a slow and cumbersome. So this is a graphic representation, Chair, of the key objectives which I've just highlighted before. Turning to the structure of the amendments themselves, Chair, because 1 to 50 will contain various technical amendments as well as OTIN's over-the-counter and insolvency amendments, over-the-counter derivatives and other insolvency amendments. Clause 51, Chair, will provide for the meat of the framework, the resolution measures, as well as deposit insurance clauses. And then clause 52 to 61, Chair, are the long title amendment and the general amendment. The bill contains the following key proposals. The bill will enhance the Reserve Bank's financial stability mandate and expand on its objectives for deposit insurance. The scope of application will be all banks, systemically important non-bank financial institutions, and their holding companies. Stabilization powers to include bail-in, transfer of certain assets and liabilities, as well as the creation of bridge institution. The resolution authority, which will be the Reserve Bank, will be responsible for the development of resolution plans for all designated institutions, which are all banks and non-bank SIFIs, as outlined earlier. The last key proposal is safeguards to include new proposed creditor hierarchy, which we'll go into in slightly more detail later in the presentation. As well, this will also adhere to the no creditor worse off principle. So I'll just quickly go through the framework and as well as the corresponding powers and functions. The key parts of the framework I've outlined in the previous slide, so I won't spend too much time on that. I will just quickly go through the Reserve Bank's powers and functions. And those will be, Chair, on the right-hand side, power to remove and replace management and recover monies from those responsible for failures, power to terminate and assign contractual agreements, appointments of resolution and resolution practitioners with delegated powers, power to establish bridge institutions and transfer selected assets and liabilities, as well as power to take bail-in action whilst respecting the hierarchy of claims and liquidations. Okay. As I outlined previously, Chair, a key element of the proposed framework is the recognition and the elevation of ordinary depositors in resolution. And what you'll see on the right-hand side is the current creditor hierarchy. At the moment, when an institution is in resolution or being liquidated, the following or the current hierarchy is observed. We have first, the first people to get their money back are secure creditors. And that's really because they already have provided funding or finance to an institution against specific assets and already have those assets. We then have preferred creditors. And then lastly, as a single group, we have unsecured creditors. And in this group are depositors currently. And what this means, Chair, is that they would have to stand in line with a whole host of other creditors and get money back on a pari passu basis. Which means that all the creditors in this very large category get the money back at the same time, which is a very long process. And because of the large size of this group, reduces the likelihood of ordinary depositors receiving their money in the event of a failure. The proposed creditor hierarchy, which you see on the right, Chair, explicitly recognizes depositors as a class and puts them and elevates their position to just behind the preferred creditors. Behind them are unsecured creditors, an additional layer of loss-absorbing capital instruments that designated institutions will be required to hold to further reduce the likelihood of their failure. And then lastly, regulatory debt instruments that many of the bank or of the designated financial institutions are currently required to hold. So what is the policy rationale for the creditor hierarchy? I've gone through some of it, Chair, but there are four main drivers for this proposal. ESSA creditor hierarchy, the current ESSA creditor hierarchy, Chair, does not recognize the distinction between ordinary depositors using a bank for transaction purposes and informed creditors and depositors and those investors making an investment for return for a financial return in the bank. Secondly, there's a need to align the bail-in sequence for creditor losses with the sequence to be followed in liquidation. Thirdly, bail-in together with creditor hierarchy should allow for an order resolution and, if necessary, winding up of a systemically important financial institution and not be restrictive for the Reserve Bank. And lastly, a creditor hierarchy that gives due regard for sophisticated creditors, i.e. institutional and corporate depositors at the wholesale level, allows for appropriate pricing of risk and certainty of ranking. In addition, Chair, a definitive creditor hierarchy will ensure transparency and avoid confusion. And lastly, there's a need to align the creditor hierarchy with international standards and countries that are regulators who oversee financial institutions operating across various jurisdictions. The summary of the proposals, Chair, are a secured and preferred creditors to retain their current ranking for depositor preference and covered depositors up to the coverage level, which we'll go through slightly later in the presentation. For unsecured creditors, currently recognized insolvency to rank below covered depositors. And then as I outlined earlier, for this FLAC instrument level, and these instruments specifically identified to be loss absorbing after regulatory capital. In addition, regulatory capital requirements are designed to bear going concern losses. Lessons from previous bank failures show that regulatory capital is often insufficient by the time a SIFI enters resolution. Additional requirements for large financial institutions to hold instruments is therefore required over and above a regulatory capital current regulatory capital for loss absorption and resolution. Lastly, Chair, regulatory capital has to be available to absorb shocks and losses during normal times and prevent failure. If there are regulatory capital left when a bank fails, the creditor hierarchy should ensure that the instruments identified as regulatory capital are the first in line to suffer losses. And this will further safeguard those vulnerable depositors. I will now turn to deposit insurance, Chair, as we conclude the presentation. We're quite excited about this innovation, Chair. As we outlined previously, our approach to the compensation of ordinary depositors has been funded by the taxpayers and not the sector itself. In our proposal, this will be an explicit member-funded or industry-funded scheme, and it will allow for the quick, transparent, and clear compensation of the most vulnerable and the least sophisticated amongst us who really use banks as a place to conduct critical economic activity. We all witnessed the very concerning and heartbreaking visuals, Chair, of long lines of people in waiting and hoping to be compensated, arising of our most recent bank failure, which was a VBS failure. The advantages of the proposed deposit insurance scheme are manifold, Chair, but include eliminating risk to depositors from losing their funds that deprive them of their livelihoods. It will also promote competitiveness of smaller banks. The idea that a bigger bank is more stable will be mitigated by this blanket measure, which will allow all banks or depositors from all banks to claim their fund in the event of failure. It'll also improve confidence and reduce risks of bank runs. It'll ensure continued access of funds during a bank failure. It'll minimize contagion. It'll enhance South Africa's market integrity, which in turn ensures investor confidence. It'll allow smaller, it'll the management of smaller bank crises with minimum disruption. It'll protect the fiscus from bailouts. It'll put the cost of failure on banks. And those who benefit from the bank in good times instead of the taxpayer in general. It will provide certainty for guaranteed depositor payout amounts and timing of those repayments. And it will also align us with international best practices. Currently, we are the last remaining G20 country without such a mechanism. The policy objectives, Chair, like I've outlined previously in the previous slide, will be the protection of depositors up to a qualifying amount of 100,000 rand per depositor per bank. It'll provide a safety net for ordinary depositors, minimize disruption, as well as allow for a crisis management tool, as I've outlined in the previous slide. Some of the structural features of the deposit insurance scheme are the following. It will be housed in the Reserve Bank. It will be a subsidiary of the Reserve Bank. The membership will be comprised of registered and licensed banks, all registered and licensed banks. The fund will consist of premiums collected, funds by banks, and the investment return on these funds. The funding of of the deposit insurance, I will go through in slightly more detail in the next slide, but there are three elements. There's a levy, a premium, and a liquidity tranche. In this slide, Chair, I show the three tranches that I mentioned in slightly more detail. A levy, which covers the operational costs, and will be 0.015 of the covered deposit. There will be a liquidity tier, and that will be comprised of interest earning assets from banks. It will be adjusted monthly in line with the covered deposit balance, used for liquidity during payouts as an advance against liquidation proceeds. Excuse me. Excuse me, Chair. There's a high degree of certainty of recovery from liquidation proceeds due to the position of covered deposits, as we saw in the proposed creditor hierarchy. The other tranche will be this equity tier, which will be funded through premiums and a flat premium of 20 basis points per year. And if there's a shortfall in liquidation proceeds, premiums by banks can be adjusted. As an additional backstop, Chair, there will be an emergency funding mechanism as a backstop to be provided by the Reserve Bank. The proposed design features, just to elaborate on those, Chair, will include a single customer view to allow for efficient payouts. And that is really what that means, Chair, is that every bank across various accounts that an individual may hold will consolidate this into a single view of the customer and then provide coverage subject to the coverage threshold on the consolidated deposits that a customer may have across the bank. It'll also provide for increased consumer education for how the scheme works, which I think will be important. Thirdly, there'll be limited support for open resolution strategies subject to conditions. And what this really means, Chair, is that if the deposit insurance scheme can help facilitate a resolution without closing a bank, that will result in less disruption for depositors, it may contribute to that resolution strategy. And lastly, there'll be an emergency liquidity facility provided by the SARB as a backstop in the event of insufficient funds, as I mentioned in the previous slide. So I've covered an awful lot, Chair, and thank you for your attention. I'm just going to try to summarize the rationale and what we hope to achieve ambitious but really important piece of legislation. And that really is, Chair, from what we saw in the global financial crisis, that that event, as well as what's been happening domestically in South Africa in our own experience with bank failures, shows that there are regulatory gaps, especially for banks which operate on a cross-border basis. And this is that doom loop that I described earlier. Large financial institutions, Chair, which are the systemically important financial institutions, are typically fail. They require more than the current business rescue, insolvency, and curatorship provisions to ensure orderly resuscitation and a winding down process. The regulatory framework requires a legal process that entails early intervention, as well as crisis planning, crisis management, to allow for an orderly wind down and minimize the disruption to the broader economy and ordinary depositors. In 2009, Chair, South Africa took steps to adopt this resolution framework in line with best practices as recognized by the G20 and the FSB. And this bill is consistent with those best practices. Lastly, Chair, as I mentioned, are the lessons that we have had through the African Bank and VBS, and that there's a need for additional powers during an intervention and an explicit privately funded deposit insurance scheme to protect those that are most vulnerable amongst us. Thank you, Chair. That brings me to the end of but before I conclude, Chair, just to highlight what's been happening at the SCOF. In addition to that, we had introduced or proposed two new small technical amendments to the original bill as tabled, and those were an expansion of clause 35 to include subsection B, which is a branch as defined to the Banks Act, as well as in addition to what we already had, which are banks under the Banks Act, Mutual Banks and Cooperative Banks Act. As well as that, we expanded the areas for regulatory cooperation to include standards, the power to issue standards, directives, and promote awareness amongst financial customers of the protections afforded under the deposit insurance chapter. Okay, that finally brings me to the end of the presentation. Thank you for listening, and I know it was a lot to cover, but thank you, Chair, for indulging us.
Lukile.
Yes, Chair.
My friend. Firstly, it's a very good presentation. I get the feeling almost like you're almost apologetic. And I don't know why. Firstly, about using our time, because you are very good and very comprehensive, which is exactly what we want. I have been telling Cindy that as much as we value Momo, it's wonderful there's a new crop of young people coming up. And you're all very bright, actually, in my view, and very, like, knowledgeable. I may disagree with you ideologically and so on, but at times. But it's impressive. It's a new lot. Plus, it's immensely boring to see the same faces like Yunus Karim and Ismail Momaniat, and soon it'll be Dick Lady Mashlangu, who must also make way, and so on, with due respect to her, although she's a nicer looking than either of the two ugly men. But you know what? You made a very good input in my view, but more importantly, there's another aspect of, let's say, an apologetic tone. I'm not sure why. You see, I'm reporting because I was around for the last 5 years. Members need to know this. What happened in 2008 and subsequently was horrific, horrific. I saw, Vukile, not so long ago, something on Netflix, something, that if you look at the horror of what was caused by the greed of the financial sector institutions and those who function within it, very few people paid the price. When little men and women, mostly men, paid the price, well, that's fair, because men are disproportionately causing all these problems. But nobody really high up paid the price. And they were rescued by the private sector, by the states, you know, as you know more than me. So I don't think we need to be apologetic. This bill is long overdue. We were hoping it'll get to us even before the last elections. We know it's in the pipeline, so it's a good bill overall. We may have problems here and there. It's a very good bill. It's no need to be apologetic. Secondly, to extend, unless I misunderstand, Wiki, this is sort of bill that people across the, let's say, a political divide in this parliament may agree to. But we simply cannot let the banks get away. Here, right here now, those with VBS. Who paid the price? Once again, disproportionately poor people. It was horrendous, you're right to point out, to see those queues. I was found by somebody that intervened and it became a big thing in the media and so on. When somebody phoned me to say, have you seen the queues? And so on. And the bank, Reserve Bank was passed on it too, I must confess. So, you know, between the banks and the parliamentary committee, we made it a big issue. But not the banks, the Reserve Bank. All right, so basically, my friend, I don't know whether I'm correct in seeing this slightly apologetic. This bill is necessary. There's no need to apologize for it. It's long overdue. It's the interests of the disadvantaged and poor and so on. So having said that, it's part of the tranche, colleagues, of the new Twin Peaks model. Bukila explained some of the bills that have come already and been confirmed in law, as law, and some that are yet to come. Kofi in particular, as we call it. Right, over then to the members. Whose hands are up? I see no hands up. You see, I told you, Bukila, it's across political parties people like this bill. Even Mr. Wright has got nothing to say.
Chairperson.
Ah, Zulani, yes.
No, Chair, let me thank the presenters for such an elaborate presentation, which clearly is a well-thought-through process which has brought us to where we are today. But I just want to know, as you are saying, you're correct to saying it's a very good presentation, and perhaps it's a very good bill for all intents and purposes. But I just want to check, when you go into this kind of process of putting together a bill of this magnitude, I assume that you also use some benchmarks with some successful economies or power brokers out there in the world. So I just want to check from the presenters, if they threw any good practice, through some good lessons somewhere in the world, maybe from the Western countries as well as from the Asian tigers, including China. I'm saying that, Chair, because you see, our structure of our laws, you can clearly see that they draw in the main from the West. So it is important to test and check, actually, if there is a good mix of good practices where we pick up the best from anywhere else in the West, not just from one direction, so that we then customize and localize for our own environment. So it is also important in this case that we don't only fly out of the continent. We can also check within the continent where there are best practices, for instance, next door in Botswana, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to check, just broadly speaking, because as you are saying, that you can see that the authors have really applied themselves very well into the detail and the chronology which you see that is entailed. So that will be my first question, Chair. I will reserve my second, third, and the fourth question for later. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Don't you want to bring them in now? Because it's not as if there's people flooding to ask questions. So do you want to bring them in now, or do you want to come in later?
Let me come later, Chair, as I indicated. Thank you for offering.
All right, fine. Then there's only Mr. Ryder left.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Just on a lighter note, I think that based on your introduction and then your comments at the end of the presentation, Chair, perhaps we should be thanking people for sending in their apologies on the odd occasion. Just a joke, Chair. Thank you. Chairperson, yes, thank you for the presentation, and I think that I'm going to ask some questions, and I may be playing devil's advocate here a little bit, just to get a bit better understanding of things. So please don't read too much into the angle of my questions. But the need for this bill has been couched in very broad terms, and actually largely ignores the fact that the subprime bubble of 2008 was extremely well weathered by the mainstream banking sector in South Africa. So the fact is that, you know, we're introducing a bill, and the bill is designed to achieve certain outcomes. But I'm wondering, you know, the Reserve Bank already has its reserve requirements that it enforces quite strongly and harshly and consistently, certainly with the bigger banks. And I note that there was a lot of comments about the non-mainstream banks in the introduction of the bill. And I'm wondering if we are doing a one-size-fits-all approach and perhaps punishing the big banks and increasing their cost of compliance. And one really needs to note that the cost of compliance for banks has become substantial in the last 18 years or so, with the introduction of FICA, with the introduction of the credit bill, credit act, etc. The cost of compliance by the major banks has become huge, and I am under no illusion that they've absorbed these costs. They've obviously passed it on to the consumers. So the costs of compliance with this new act is ultimately going to be passed on to consumers in one way or the other, because shareholders will be shielded, and that's capitalism. And so I'm just wondering if we're not, you know, trying to enforce something and ending up with a different unleveled playing field is what I want to say, and actually advantaging some of the illicit players in the market. And of course, we must take note, Chair, that using VBS as an example is not a good example, because VBS was not a banking failure. VBS was a criminal exercise. It was absolute pillaging. It was blatantly done, illegal acts done blatantly with no fear of consequences. And, you know, once again, we cannot expect people that are behaving like that to comply with certain regulations. When people set out to steal, they're not going to steal within the nice regulations that we've set. They're going to steal and break your rules as well. So I'm wondering if we are using a blunt instrument here and applying it consistently across the board, when perhaps that might be a little bit unfair to apply it across the board, especially noting the barriers to entry that there are in place in the banking industry. So for a small player to become a medium player is incredibly difficult already as it is. And I think that's probably my next question is, are we not increasing the barriers to entry for new entrants? And you know, perhaps we can ask the Competition Commission what they think of this bill, because this is going to make it more increasingly difficult for new entrants to enter the market. And I mean, you know, we had a launch recently, it was during this past week, that we've had a launch of a young women's bank, a mutual bank that's been launched in South Africa. And I mean, they face a massive uphill battle as they try to build themselves up over time. And, you know, some of that battle is necessary, because we need to test their systems and make sure that they are compliant and that they don't put investors and depositors at risk. But the fact is that, you know, I'm just wondering what level, how many more barriers to entry are we putting in place by the by proposing the current bill? You know, so in 2002 we had the small bank run. We had serious problems with the collapse. I think it was precipitated by Sambo, you know, way back then, and there was a spillover effect. You know, I'm just trying to work out, what is this bill in response to the 2002? You've mentioned 2008, and I'm afraid I don't buy it, because I think that the implication or the implementation of Basel II, the Basel II Accord by our big banks, certainly protected us from a lot of the 2008 fallout that many other countries experienced. And you know, we've had Basel III and I think four as well since then, where these things have been well bashed out and hammered out. And South Africa is actually, our banking system and our Reserve Bank has been at the fore of this, has implemented these resolutions extremely well. And that has cushioned us well. And that's why we've always sat with this the comment that South Africa's banking system is streaks ahead of the majority of the world. You know, we punch way above our weight in the banking sector. So really, I'm trying to get to what was the trigger? What are we trying to fix here? If we're trying to fix VBS, I don't think it's the right tool. If we're trying to ensure that our system is a little bit stronger, you know, is it really necessary to go to this extent or apply this across the board to everybody? Could we have a more of a focus on smaller banks? You know, I don't know how you would legislate for that. But I really would think that we need to start thinking quite cleverly and making sure that we're not punishing people for doing business well over the years, and also punishing, you know, the people that do things right. So again, the cost of compliance is expensive, but only if you bother to comply. Chair, I'm going to leave it at that. I just feel like we need a little bit more guidance as to, you know, what are we trying to prevent? What has triggered us? And, you know, are we being overly cautious, or are we being careful with across the board regulations like this? Thanks, Chair.
There doesn't seem to be any other questions for now. Can you respond to this, please? What has been said already by your team? Zolani, you want to come in?
Yes, yeah.
Go ahead, please.
No, Chair, I see that on the issues of transformation, I would like to hear them. Because whenever we consider a bill in this sector and other mainstream sectors of our economy, we have to raise this question because it's critical to ensure a necessary change, including ownership at the uppermost, even the adherence to the financial charter, which was set up some time ago, which many of these banks have not really complied. So when we put, a bill out there, it is important that it also seeks to address the issues of historical sectors, which had marginalized the majority of South Africans who happen to be African and black in general. So one wonders if a bill of this nature is not going to maintain the status quo if it is silent to issues of transformation, because there's dominance of the big 4+1 in the banking sector, and they are historically white banks, but they are part and parcel of the South African experience. So what is important is an appreciation of that fact and therefore do something about it, which uppermost in that agenda is to ensure that the African majority become part and parcel of ownership, because a bank is central to the means and the factors of production in any given society. So its ownership is therefore critical in terms of its relationship with its citizenry. If it is one-sided, that speaks volumes insofar as regression is concerned. And what we want is progression, and progression to us means that we need to address issues of ownership of these means of production. Secondly, this is a secondary issue. The banks are given an instruction or a mandate to to be very much involved in consumer education of the population. And they are expected to put resources behind that so that people of a country are educated about their rights, as well as the guarantees in the Bill of Rights of the Constitution when it comes to issues of financial institutions that they engage on daily basis, either depositing or withdrawing or buying insurances and everything that is entailed in the products which are available in the banking sector. So there has been leniency in terms of what is expected of them, particularly in the rural communities. I don't see that kind of education. And our people are victims of charges that are unexplained in their accounts by some dodgy characters that are using the banking sector. So it is important that this bill also seek to address that no charges must be effected into my bank account without my consent. And the bank should not allow things like those, because millions of rands, if not billions, which are taken illegally from our people through these deductions and stop orders that are unauthorized by customers and consumers, leave much to be desired. And I think a prudential authority of this magnitude, therefore, needs to also address those matters as a matter of urgency. And lastly, the banks are expected to play a role like all other corporate citizens in the country, a role in the social investment programs of this country. I know for a fact that they do such, especially in urban areas. But almost half of the population of the country reside in villages. I would love to see this bank giving back to rural communities, really showing visibility in terms of putting their money for social investment in building schools, clinics, and also the infrastructure, so that there is no case of an excuse of setting up even ATMs in the middle of nowhere where people live in rural communities. Because ATMs cannot only be an issue of townships and the cities. So I want to say that I would like Treasury to look into this, to make a compelling case for banks when they do social investment, that they look across the country and appreciate that this country is predominantly a rural country in its complexion, and therefore they cannot only be focused in urban areas, even though their head offices are all situated in urban areas. But they must appreciate that in terms of their clientele comes across the length and the breadth of the country, including rural and peri-urban areas. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
I don't see any other hands. Can you go for it, Bukile and your team? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for all of those questions. They were all, I think, very important questions that need to be addressed. I will take them in order, and I will also ask at the end of it, Chair, I will ask my colleagues from the Reserve Bank to add some detail on some technical detail if I have omitted anything, particularly the second set of questions which relate to which I think Honourable Ryder asked. The first question, Chair, was about benchmarking and best practice, and I think that this is it's a very important question and something that we have made a huge amount of effort to ensure. The bill, Chair, was really driven, as I said at the top of the presentation, by two sets of experiences, and this also may in part respond to the second question, but it was driven by international experience and what we saw. It was also driven by some of our own experiences here in South Africa. A lot of our own experiences were echoed in other events internationally. And in coming up with the framework and the bill, we definitely sought to make sure that we were consistent with international best practice and what was happening in a diverse set of countries where those financial systems have features that look like ours. We're particularly interested in those sets of countries that are on the same developmental, had the same sort of developmental experience as South Africa, including the Latin American countries and then Asian tigers, as the honourable member mentioned. These were coordinated through the group, the G20's body that specifically focuses on financial sector issues, called the Financial Stability Board, where the Asian members are a mix of developing and advanced economies. The developing economies are China, Indonesia, India, who have also enacted a framework that is substantively the same as this, but also, like you say, slightly augmented calibrated for domestic conditions. But the principles and the objectives that we've outlined today have been consistently implemented in those countries as well as peer countries in Latin America, like Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico. Not to mention, of course, the other large advanced economies in the EU, US, and other places. So to answer your question more directly, we have certainly made sure that this is consistent with international best practice, and it is, and a similar framework has been applied in those peer countries. On the continent, we've also noted that our peers are moving along with us. Botswana and Namibia are in advanced stages of introducing similar mechanisms for deposit insurance. And I think that this speaks to both the need and the desire to have coordinated regulatory improvements in our respective jurisdictions. Turning to the second question, Chair, are we applying a one size fits all, and are we introducing too much sort of red tape and increasing the cost of compliance? So, Chair, I think that there are two very important things to consider here. The first one, as I described in the presentation, is that a lot of what the bill seeks to do is to reduce moral hazard, and that is to align or to make sure that those that benefit in good times are able to pay in bad times, and that may necessitate an increase in compliance costs to make sure that happens. It's not something that we hope will happen. We don't hope for a failure, but we certainly recognize that we need to plan for one to ensure that if one ever occurs, we're able to have the tools to sufficiently deal with that crisis. The second one in answering the honorable member's question is really goes to the heart of trust and confidence. It doesn't necessarily matter that one institution is not the source of the problems. What we've seen in other jurisdictions as well as in South Africa is that even if there's a problem in a relatively small institution like there was an African bank that can be quickly be transmitted to other institutions. So therefore, bolstering the confidence and the stability of the entire system is necessary and an important part of what the bill seeks to do. We certainly learned a lot of lessons, particularly as they apply to deposit insurance from VBS. I think it's important to note that this isn't the problem we are seeking to address. We learned very important lessons in the failure of African Bank. And the failure of African Bank is quite instructive when one thinks about the idea that a failure of a small bank does not affect the larger banks. Part of the resolution of African Bank required the largest banks to take up to provide resources to aid in the resolution of African Bank. And they didn't do that out of the sort of goodness of their heart. I think those banks themselves recognized that it was incredibly important to stabilize African Bank because the trust and confidence issues could have easily been transmitted into their own banks. And those banks provided substantial resources in the ultimate resolution of African Bank. And I think that maybe underscores this point that we can't, it's not entirely appropriate to think about these institutions as a sort of island. They're all interconnected, and what happens in one area is important for another. Before addressing some of the other issues, Chair, if you'd allow me to pause for just a minute and allow Jacques, the head of resolution from the Reserve Bank, to add any thoughts or technical clarity to the response I've given so far. Jacques?
Thanks, Bukile, and good morning, Chair and members, and thank you for the questions. Bukile, I think you covered most of the questions very well. Perhaps just to add on the second question by Mr. Ryder on the regulatory cost, I do think that we do not just need to look at the regulatory costs. As Bukile said, that it is expected that there might be a cost of compliance that this framework will introduce, but there's also benefits that the framework will introduce as well. We've done a cost-benefit analysis. We had consultants do a cost-benefit study that was published end of last year. There's a number of things that will have a benefit to banks. For example, the deposit insurance scheme for the smaller players. There's a risk for depositors if they look at perhaps VBS, and there's a risk to the access of their funds. So deposit insurance will bring in a certain sort of benefit for that. And then also, when you look at the models that rating agencies use to rate the instruments of banks, they are considering new resolution rating models. As you know, currently, none of bank instruments can pierce the sovereign ceiling. If you do introduce a proper resolution framework with the necessary loss-absorbing instruments, there is a possibility that some of the instruments issued by these banks can pierce the sovereign debt ceiling. So there are also a number of benefits. And over and above that, unfortunately, bank failures do pose a trade-off. They have a cost, and somebody must bear that cost. So I think although we can say that no South African banks failed as a result of the 2008 global financial crisis, we can look at that crisis and we can take certain lessons from that. If we look at what the governments had to do, for example, the US government had to spend $700 billion on bailouts, can we really afford for one of our bigger institutions to fail? Not that there's a great likelihood of that happening, but can we really wait for one of those institutions to fail before we take action? And I think that's sort of why the example of the 2008 financial crisis is often used, is that there's a lot of lessons that we could learn from those experiences before they happen locally. And also similar to the BBS and African Bank cases, Vukile has talked about this, but we don't necessarily say because we had the BBS failure and we had the African Bank failure, you know, we need a new resolution framework. We look at the lessons from that. So if we look at BBS, we might not derive a lot of resolution lessons from the BBS, but on the deposit insurance, we certainly learned a lot of lessons. We had to do an ad hoc depositor payout. We looked at the vulnerable depositors that were sleeping outside the bank until government came out and said there will be a guarantee. And we want to avoid those situations. There was a lot of hardship for a lot of the depositors. And certainly having an explicit depositor guarantee scheme would avoid a lot of that hardship. And then on the African Bank case, as Vukile has pointed out, there was also a lot of lessons that we learned from that. As members know, amendments had to be made to the Banks Act to introduce certain provisions to allow the curator to take certain actions. And if we scale that to some of our systemically important financial institutions, we can see that the current framework is insufficient should one of those entities fail, and we need additional measures, and that's what the framework will provide for. Thanks, Vukile. I just wanted to add on that. Thanks, Chair. Thanks, members.
Thank you, Jacques. I will continue on, Chair, for the remaining last two questions briefly. The third one was on transformation, which is rightfully pointed out by the Honourable Member is a very important issue. Although this bill doesn't specifically deal with transformation, Chair, it does advance those objectives in its crafting. It does so in two important ways, Chair. The first one is, as Jacques outlined, Chair, and as you did yourself earlier, the protection of the most vulnerable amongst us is an incredibly important and progressive mechanism. It was recognize as so in our deliberations in SCOF, amongst the stakeholders, and we really hope that this will be we certainly know by how we've designed the features of the deposit insurance, which is really calibrated at covering in the mid-90s of depositors in the countries, the percent of depositors, that this is something that will have a meaningful impact amongst the most vulnerable of us. The second dimension, Chair, as the Honourable Member who asked the question outlined, that we need to ensure competition in the sector. The deposit insurance, Chair, will bolster confidence amongst consumers to move their accounts from the larger banks to smaller, more agile new entrants in the full knowledge that even if the worst happens, their deposits will be protected. And we really expect this to bolster and improve competition, particularly amongst new entrants in the financial sector. So in these two dimensions, although like I said at the top of the response, Chair, we aren't specifically dealing with transformation in the scope of this bill. We expect that there will be some significant benefits and advances on the transformation and competition agenda through aspects of this bill. I will deal with the last question as well quickly, and then invite my colleague Janine to speak about upcoming legislation, which is much more squarely designed to deal with the issues raised by the members. But before I do, just to mention, Chair, that the deposit insurance scheme has in law and as part of its core mandate a consumer education aspect and dimension, and in recognition of the importance of consumer education, as the honourable member had mentioned. But let me pass over to Janine to speak about complementary legislation, which we had outlined at the very top of the presentation, which is much more squarely calibrated at dealing with the issues raised by the member. Janine.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members and Vukile. Just briefly to come in on the questions from Honourable Nkiva on transformation, which are, as Vukile has noted, very important considerations. I'd just like to note that this bill, a large portion of it constitutes amendments to the Financial Sector Regulation Act, which in its object, among its objects, includes transformation of the financial sector and also provides for consideration of transformation as one of the key elements of the regulation and supervision of the financial sector. So because these provisions are being incorporated into the Financial Sector Regulation Act, it will be incorporated into the overall framework, which includes transformation as an important consideration of the regulation and supervision of all financial institutions, including the banks, which are very important financial institutions in the sector. A lot of the elements, particularly that have been noted relating to transformation, relate to the conduct of financial institutions. And an important element of the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill, which we are finalizing, ready to propose for tabling in Parliament, and we hope will be tabled during the course of this year, will promote requirements relating to transformation, particularly requiring financial institutions to have transformation plans and policies in place, which would be supervised particularly by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, and also strengthening powers to make requirements in respect of transformation. So we are envisaging that the COFI bill will provide a very important element to promote transformation in the financial sector, which will be an important aspect for both the Prudential Authority and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority to be considering in their regulation and supervision. But the Financial Sector Conduct Authority in particular would be really trying to ensure that transformation is an important aspect of the governance and operations of all financial institutions, who will, by virtue of their activities, fall under the regulation of the Conduct Authority. So the banks will be falling under the regulation of the Conduct Authority. And just to note that the Conduct Authority has already been issuing conduct standards relating to banks in relation to how they treat certain aspects relating to financial customers, including closing accounts, etc. And there will probably be additional appropriate standards that would be issued to address by the Conduct Authority to address various impacts on financial customers that may be identified and that would need to be addressed. And so we will be certainly engaging further with this committee when we bring the COFI bill in the not too distant future and can have a significant further engagement on transformation in that regard. And finally, just to note, consumer education is also a very important objective that's also facilitated through the Conduct Authority in particular, and it will be implemented in to some extent through the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill. So we certainly thank Honourable Nkiva for those very important questions, and we can certainly engage further on those, particularly as we discuss and as we will be processing the Conduct of Financial Institutions Bill. Thank you very much.
Are you done, Vukile, with your team?
I am, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Colleagues, this is an initial foray. We're just coming to terms with the broad concepts of the bill and so on. Obviously, we will have public hearings and then we'll go through it line by line and so on. So there's still plenty to do. But we should try to finish this bill before the end of the next quarter. So members will have time to look more carefully at the bill by the time we come back. I just wanted to clarify something. Well, firstly, I wanted to ask if I've got this correct. You say that the Standing Committee only made two amendments to the bill. Is that correct, the two that you pointed to? Or have I got that wrong?
Yes, Chair. So the two additional amendments were actually requested by ourselves, and those were two sort of technical drafting corrections that we proposed. Janine, you can.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. There were a few other minor technical corrections that are proposed to be made. They have not yet been adopted formally by the House, the National Assembly, that arose out of submissions on the bill. And when we come back, we can perhaps go into those in a bit more detail. Those were really technical amendments, particularly relating to referencing and clarification of minor wording. But we wanted to...
That's not a big deal, yeah. But on policy issues, there weren't any changes in effect.
No, there weren't any.
For the entire bill.
No, there weren't.
All right. Okay, thank you very much. All right, in that case, colleagues, we're done for now. I thank everybody. Dennis, you want to come in? Fine.
Sorry, Chair. Thanks very much. Yeah, I see we're well ahead of time. So I just wanted to ask two quick questions, if I may, with your indulgence, Chair.
but we shouldn't have questions simply because we finished before time. It's about productivity, but go right ahead, yes.
No, thank you very much, Chair. Good. So the first question is perhaps just about the responses, and I think Mr. Boerter spoke about the lessons learned, certainly with the African bank issues. And I think that obviously if one analyzes the African bank situation, you can see that one of their problems was the risk weighting of their book and their inability to properly manage that and to account for it in terms of predicting the potential for fallout. So the one question that I will have to ask is there any consideration being given to having a risk weighting to any of the contributions that are being made in terms of this? So specifically the deposit insurance scheme. You know, would the percentage be flexible or variable depending on risk weightings? I do know that banks take a lot of time and effort to categorize their risk weightings these days and the risk of their book. So, you know, I think that would possibly be quite a logical step and probably then also rewarding banks for taking making lower risk advances, I guess. But I guess on the same hand, it would probably marginalize banks that have a more developmental aspect. And then, of course, the big question around the deposit insurance scheme. Now, for those that don't know me, I'm a massive optimist. So I'm going to say that, you know, what happens if we don't have any banks failing in the next 20 years and we build up a massive surplus in the deposit insurance scheme? You know, what's to be done with that? And those that don't know me will know I'm a massive pessimist. And I want to say that, you know, is this going to be a slush fund available for looting? Or, you know, will there be some sort of a review? Potential of giving some of this back, and you know, after 20 years, all the contributors still around that we, you know, that we give these funds back to. just some comments on that. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, Bukele, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I will pass this on to the CEO of the deposit insurance scheme, Mr. Hendrik Nel, to deal with these specific issues.
Thank you, Vukile. Thank you, Chair. I can respond to the questions from Honourable Member Ryder, but I also have two young and very knowledgeable colleagues on the line in the call that can also come in, please, at any time. So just on the question regarding the risk weighting of premiums for banks for deposit insurance, we are not applying a risk-weighted premium for banks at the moment. It is something that we will look into going forward, but at the moment it is a flat rate of equal rate for all banks on their premiums. But as I said, it's something to consider going forward. And then the second question, if we don't have any banks failing, it will really be wonderful. That is what we hope for. Will we build up massive surpluses in the deposit insurance fund? No, we will not. As Vukile has explained, we have developed quite a unique funding structure for the deposit insurance fund. And the main reason for that is to reduce the burden on the banks. One of your earlier questions as well, where you indicated the cost of compliance on banks and whether we're not overburdening banks. We are very aware of the compliance burden on banks. And in developing the funding model for deposit insurance, we came up with this unique funding model where we reduce the burden on the banks through a liquidity tier, whereby banks will be investing an amount, specified amount, depending on their covered deposits that the banks hold. They will invest that amount with the corporation on which they will earn an interest. But that will be up to a certain amount. So there's a specified amount for the deposit insurance fund beyond which it will not go. So there won't be a buildup of massive surpluses in the deposit insurance fund. It'll be built up to the point where it can cover the failure of one or two banks simultaneously. So you look at probabilities of failure and build up a fund to be able to cover depositors. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, is there anything else? Nope. All right, thank you all. And colleagues, we'll see you whenever. Thank you indeed. Bye.
Thanks for attending, Chair.